update. The Diamondbacks set to take on the Pittsburgh Pirates here at 12:40. We're out at Chase Field. Luke Kupinski alongside Dan Bickley, joined now by Diamondbacks starter Clay Buchholz. Clay, first of all, thanks for the time. You've had quite the ride this season to get to this point, but it seems like you're settling in pretty nicely with this team.
Yeah, you know, it was a different offseason, I think, for everybody that was going into any type of free agency or trying to find a team to play for. So to start, it was a little different, and you know, I had to press through and get through a couple things. Got this reported to spring training with the Royals, with a week left in camp, and went that route. And all in all, ended up here with a good group of guys, and obviously I know multiple people on the staff too. So it's been a good transition.
Now, Clay, I've been around long enough to remember when you came up into the game in Boston, and I remember watching your curveball, and just I was stunned at the movement. I'm like, wow, this guy's got a live arm. And here you are all these years later. You had to fight your way back to get this opportunity. You just kind of touched on that journey. What has that been like for somebody who had all that success and then had a fight to get back to where you are now?
Yeah, it was difficult at times. The game is getting younger by each year. There's just so many good, young, talented players coming up that, you know, all in all, they're cheaper than guys that have been around for a little bit. And I think that's pressing and pushing the 30, 33, 34-year-old guys. That's sort of pushing them out of the game. And to fight that adversity, that was a little different. And I think that everything happens for a reason, for sure. There's been multiple times throughout my career that, you know, things haven't looked like you want them to look, and the process was a little tough. But I think if you get through it, it makes you stronger. And the results are, this game's a result-oriented game. But I think if you just trust the process and know that you're going to succeed if you keep putting the work in, that's where I'm at right now.
Has it been much of an adjustment becoming a National League pitcher? If I remember right, you had a couple games with Philadelphia, but the rest of your career has been with the Red Sox. To come over here, I know you see some of these teams in the interleague anyway, but to be consistently facing NL teams now in NL Park, is that different?
Yeah, you know, it really is. Because you have to work on both facets of the game. You have to work and take BP, which is that was a little different for me to come into a place and, you know, regularly take hacks. You know, in interleague play in American League, we'd start hitting maybe a week and a half before the series started, and then, you know, you wouldn't have another interleague start for that might be your only one for the whole season. So, and on that side of the ball, it's a little different, but you know, it's fun. It's sometimes if you're struggling on the mound and you know that you can go up and put a good at bat together, maybe knock a drive a run in and help yourself out, help the team out. You're able to pick yourself up and forget about what you did on the mound the inning before and go about your business with a positive attitude.
Now, last night was really the first time that you've struggled here, but prior to that, you've had a really good run of success. And according to some of these metrics, and I'm not a big metrics guy, I'm an old school kind of guy like that, but here's what they had to say. Only one of Buchholz's pitches is above average. His cutter has been described as a worm killer that has generated a high swing and miss rate as well as a ton of ground balls. If that is true, if as a pitcher you're dealing with, as all people do in the age, maybe diminished velocity, how are you getting so many major league hitters out now?
I think at the major league level, for the most part, the hitters get themselves out because they're good. And if they're disciplined at the plate and they don't go out of the zone, which this team that we're playing right now, they didn't do a whole lot of that last night. So that's why the counts went. I went deep into counts and they had a good approach. But, you know, I feel like if you can command multiple pitches on both sides of the plate, you can get guys out because they will have to swing at it if they're behind in the count. And that's the starts prior to the one last night. That's what I was doing. I was doing a good job of commanding the zone and being able to cut and sink the ball on both sides of the plate.
And your command has been really, really good since you've gotten here. As a pitcher, and I referenced analytics, do you see it and feel it as a pitcher that maybe lineups and opposing teams are making adjustments quicker than they do in the past? Are they able to kind of change and get better game plans against a pitcher quicker than in the past?
Because you have infinite amount of video that you can watch, and you know, the scouting reports that are even given to us, you can have as much information as you want or as little. And you know, the greatest hitters in the game, they make adjustments from pitch to pitch. They don't they don't wait for the next game or the next at bat. They can make an adjustment within the at bat, and that's what makes it tough to double up on a certain pitch and or double up on a certain location, because they might be sitting on it and waiting on it, and that's the cat and mouse game.
So now you started the game last night. You got the day game here today. Take us through what a starting pitcher does, like, the day after he's pitching. You're obviously out here, but I would assume you're maybe the most relaxed guy on the team, because you know you're not going out there today.
Right. No. Yeah. Day one is what we call it. Day one's it's usually a lower body lift day and your run day to get the lactic acid and everything out. So it's probably the most miserable day of the week. But you can go into the dugout, watch a big league baseball game, have the best seat in the house, and obviously we're going for a sweep today too. So that makes it a little bit better.
All right, there are guys who've come here since you, like John Jay, and you were here for some of the struggles. What do you make of a baseball team that did what this team did in May and struggled offensively the way they did and just suddenly is kind of like got back on the rails?
That's baseball. I said it after my first start, go out and throw five innings in New York, give up a run, and, we end up getting beat later in the game. But it's part of baseball. I told them that there's going to come a time where the starting staff gives up some runs, but we still get the win because the offense has turned it around, and that's what's going on right now. Yeah. It's full circle, and it always comes around. And if the hitters are confident and they trust that they're going to put up good at bats, hits start falling in, and that's the way the game works.
I want to go back to something you said earlier. It sounds like as a pitcher, you don't mind going up there and hitting every once in a while. Is that fairly universal among the pitchers?
Yeah, I think so. I think everybody at some point, most everybody on the field, if you were right-handed, was a shortstop at one point.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think that's where it comes in. I wouldn't want to be a position player now, just knowing that the grind, and it's every day, and 162 games is a long time to try to be on the field for all of them. So, we get to play. I get to pitch once every 5 days, and then be in the dugout, watch the game, watch how everything unfolds, and sort of practice doing that. But it's fun getting up there and hitting, but not with all these guys throwing 100 now. It's a little that makes it a little bit different.
Yeah. Well, today's starter Zach Greinke, he can wield a bat a little bit. So can Patrick Corbin. So yeah, the Diamondbacks have had some success with that. All right, one of the topics that really intrigues me. We saw what went down with the Pirates the other night and all the retaliation pitches. After the game, Torey Lovello said, I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of asking a guy to throw a fastball as hard as he can at another human being. He said there are other ways to exact that kind of retaliation. What are your thoughts on this, having been in a career that has spanned a couple of decades, actually 3 decades? What is your thoughts now on just how important this is? Is there a better way? Do you like being involved in games where you might have to have that responsibility? What are your thoughts on all that?
Just being in the American League and with things going on, we've had some run-ins with Tampa, with the Yankees, and the pitcher doesn't have to go up there and hit, so the pitcher's not scared of anything. The position players and the big guys, they know what's going to happen if something unfolds, and it makes it a little bit different in the National League because you have to get a bat and you have to get up there. And I think that throws a kink in it for the guy that's on the mound. But that's baseball, the history of baseball. Guys are going to take their guys back, and if they think something was intentional and it knocks one of their guys out of the game, there's probably going to be some retaliation. I think that's a given. But you got to pick your spots. I think that's a big thing. You got to know how to do it and when to do it. And like Torey said, not necessarily even have to hit anybody, but send a message. And that's been around baseball forever. I don't think that's ever going to leave.
Yeah, Torey put that point of emphasis on how the best revenge is obviously to come back and win a game like that. But in the moment, when you see one of your guys get hit and there's emotions, on the rise there, that game could have gone sideways. You guys were already down 5-0. Does anybody have to say anything in the dugout to just sort of refocus everyone? Because you don't typically see a team respond with 9 runs.
Right. Whenever CO got hit, it was obviously the dugout jumps up and yell and hollering, but when you see a couple runs cross the plate, and the guy that Musgrove, he was throwing a great game, and scored a couple runs off of him. He came out of the game, and then stuff sort of snowballed on him, and that's gratifying to be on that side of the ball and knowing that the game's not going in our favor, and to score 9 unanswered runs is a big deal.
Oh, no doubt.
And to make the most of of the opportunity with getting a guy on base and then moving him over and then getting a triple and then Lammer's home run. That's the way the game's written.
It just seems so weird that a guy who could be dealing like that would either be asked or felt compelled to throw at the first guy who's hitting sub 200. There could have been a better time and a place to do that.
Like two outs,
right? You know what I'm saying? That you don't derail your own great start.
Yeah, no, it's that baffled me a little bit too. That's how I was always brought up within the game. If you're retaliating, it's you go after the first two guys. If you get them both out, then that's your shot. And if you miss with it, it's over.
Yeah.
But it's the way it goes.
Yeah.
I'm glad he hit him.
So am I, man. All right, Clay, last thing. Give me, as a guy who's been in a lot of clubhouses, I ask this of new guys all the time, just give me your interpretation of just the brotherhood you feel and what it might mean in the context of winning baseball.
It's big. You know, team camaraderie is a real thing. And to know that each guy that's sitting next to you in the clubhouse or in the dugout has your back and you're all fighting for the same reason, the same goal, that goes a long way, because that picks the guys up that needs to be picked up, and it's a tough game. Some people make it look really easy sometimes, but it's a tough game, and it's a game that's built on failure. And for everybody to have each other's back and know that we're all driving forward, we all have the same goal, that's what brings everybody together, and that's what makes it fun.
It's not that way everywhere, is it? I mean, you want to think it is, but there are teams where it's just not like that.
No, I mean, yeah, you have some teams that are younger. You know, I was with the Phillies last year, and I went from being the youngest guy with the Red Sox to the oldest guy on the Phillies, and it was a big swing for me, just on an individual level. But yeah, you know, you got to learn within the game. You have to learn. You have to fail to learn, and nobody's going to go out and win every game, so that's just part of it. But yeah, you have to definitely learn through the failure, and you know, have a short memory with both of them, because you can get the big head really easy in this game, and you can get complacent, and it's hard to come back from that.
All right, Clay, thank you so much for your time, man. Continued success. You've been a valuable addition to this team, helping them get through a rough stretch. All the best to you, man. We appreciate it,
guys. Thank y'all.
You got it, baby. Clay Buchholz, starter for the Arizona Diamondbacks, joining us. 12:40 first pitch today, as we told you about. One of the topics I want to talk about, Luke, is this idea of tunneling, which I harped on frequently during the team's struggles. And for those who don't know, this was a change in approach that, if you go back, and I went and documented all of this, so you go back and compile and aggregate a lot of the reporting done by Nick Pecoro and other people who covered the Diamondbacks, they began shifting their preparation tactics towards tunneling in the final month or two of last season. They went all in with it in the postseason, and they started again in the spring training. Now, in the spring, I'm looking at a story from Nick Pecoro, and they talked about to a couple of players who really seemed to be digging this idea of looking at where the ball is coming out of a pitcher's hand to identify where it's going to end up, what kind of pitch it is, etc. It has been my contention that this has been the root of the team's problems, my suspicion. And it really kind of dovetails and with the timeline of Goldie's struggles along the way. Dave Magadan yesterday during our interview, you could tell it got a little, as Jared called it, a little spicy.
Yeah.
Right?
It's probably better that wasn't in person.
Right. It got a little spicy because you can tell when you talk to the team executives and coaches, this isn't the most popular topic that they want to address in a public forum. You could hear it again from Mike Hazen today. Do we have that cut handy, Jared, about Mike Hazen on tunneling and what it meant to the team struggles?
You look at a pitcher and where the ball comes out of, I think, is probably, you know, the simplest explanation to it. So, you know, we talk a lot about arm slot. So when we're referring to that, we're talking about sort of where the ball comes out of. And so when you're a hitter and you're watching the pitcher, you're looking where to pick the ball up. And pitchers will release it in different spots. And how they get to that spot, where their arm circle is, you know, how they take the ball out of their glove, where the ball travels behind the pitcher. I think from a tunneling standpoint, it's how they where they put the ball as it's traveling to the plate, how late the hitter has to make a decision.
Okay, now, so let's, and he talked about, as it relates to the struggles of the team, he called it more of an excuse than anything else. And it just, it seems to me when Diamondbacks executives talk about this, you can almost sense a little defensiveness. Can you?
Well, yeah, because May was such a bad month, and now we're looking at it. This is a team that can obviously is capable of hitting very well. They have 22 yeah. runs in their last two games, and
right.
they've been scoring a lot now for a few weeks. But like last year, there's a lot of offensive weapons. Start of this year, even A.J. Pollock at least was hitting really well. It didn't add up that they would hit 193 for an entire month.
No.
So it's easy to make that connection.
Well, especially when the entire lineup struggles at the same time. Now, I'm going through this story because, again, the chronology of this to me is very important. So they get out of spring training, and then through 10 games, according to Nick Pecoro, he says this: the Diamondbacks seem to be sticking to the approach. Their swing rate on pitches outside the strike zone is the lowest in the majors. They have the sixth lowest swing rate on pitches in the zone, suggesting they're not just swinging at any kind of strike. And their overall swing rate is second lowest in the majors. And what Chris Owings said at the time is, this is working for us, but it really is a matter of how much guys trust and how much how good they feel about this. I'm getting the idea that when things started to go south, maybe they began to question the approach, or maybe it locked them up, because everybody, every scout who chimed in on Paul Goldschmidt's struggles said the same thing, that he looks locked up at the plate, thinking too much, not reacting quick enough, and then, boom, that kind of explains that. Now, everything has shifted. I don't know whether, and on top of it all, if all of this was an excuse and something that was is more of a creation from us in the media and onlookers who really don't know this stuff the way those guys know this stuff.
Yeah.
Torrey Lovello admitted a while ago that sometimes I'm wondering if we're putting too much in front of these guys. Information overload. So I am not going to believe for 1 minute that this wasn't at least one of the problems that this team had to get through. Now, how did they solve it? I don't know. But suddenly Paul Goldschmidt looks different. Is it just the natural ebb and flow of baseball? Okay, if Paul Goldschmidt was the only guy that was struggling, I'd buy that. But Paul Goldschmidt struggled at a level we've never seen before. And in the same interview this morning, even though Mike Hazen came out and said this is more of an excuse than anything else, he also said what he saw in May was among the hardest struggles he's ever experienced in baseball. So this was no ordinary problem.
No, and that's the thing that it's really difficult to get past is it was tough enough to understand how Paul Goldschmidt wasn't hitting because he's been hitting so well his entire career and he's been one of the best pure hitters in baseball over the last better part of a decade. That was difficult to get past. But the other part was the fact that nobody was hitting. And so when you have that knowledge that the team is trying something new or relatively new, I mean, I don't think it's completely new. I'm sure there's been forms of this for the last, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years or whatever. Baseball players are always looking for some sort of edge out there. But when you have that perception out there, the team collectively is doing something new and they suddenly none of them can hit, It forces, I guess, the team to maybe come off as defensive, because normally when the roster is struggling, it doesn't just flip back around on the organization. Whereas in this case, you could say, well, wait a minute, you guys are asking Major League Baseball players to maybe focus on how they hit differently. You're changing their most basic instinct out there on the field.
Here's a couple of the Dave Magnin cuts from talking about why tunneling wasn't the problem, why you shouldn't blame that.
I don't think it had anything to do with it. I think tunneling is probably just another word to get a good pitch to hit. We're trying to, you know, especially with these guys that are throwing so hard and they've got wipeout sliders and, you know, it makes for a tough at bat. So we were just trying to simplify it a little bit, simplify the scouting reports where instead of, you know, a paragraph on how a guy pitches, just kind of highlight what he tries to do, what his out pitch is, and where you want the ball to start for you to put a swing on it.
And then a little spiciness.
There's a lot of reasons for teams to struggle. You know, I don't think pointing to the tunneling is something that I guess it's an easy thing to do because it was something different that we were doing, but you know, we're doing the same thing over the last 2 weeks and we're averaging 7 runs a game, so
Okay, yeah, and that's all fair, but it's also very rare to see entire lineups struggle in unison, which kind of has led to a lot of that speculation, at least on my behalf. But in the case of Paul...
So you don't think it's a good thing to look for a pitch in a certain area?
Oh, and... no. I don't have an area of expertise to even, or the context to even answer that properly.
Which I don't. I'm not immersed in this, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing. And clearly, these guys know what they're doing and bought into it so hard that they implemented it during a pennant push. Okay, so that's the level of belief they have in this concept. And my thought is when a team struggles in mass, and Paul Goldschmidt can't hit the ball and looks lost at home plate, there's something bigger going on here. Now, I get why the organization would be a little defensive about this, because they've done tons of great things with what they're great at. Analytics, data, what it means, solving problems, identifying problems, all of that. And the last thing they want to do is say, what are you guys doing here? I mean, you guys are taking this stuff way too far. And so I get why that would be the case, and maybe they're right. Maybe it's not as profound as it appears to be to me, but I don't think any other answer or explanation begins to explain what we saw with Goldie and what we saw with everybody around him. Not at once.
That's what's weird, because even if you're going to take this new approach, it's going to impact each individual differently.
Yep.
So even if it was going to negatively impact some guys, it shouldn't negatively impact all of them. That's what's been so... The month of May, I don't know if we're going to look back at the end of the season and still be scratching our heads about it, or we're going to see something like that happen again next month, and we're going to just... That's going to be their season. They're going to go back and forth. But if that truly was just an outlier, I don't remember an outlier like that with an entire team that I've ever watched.
Me neither. All right, the fun has begun in the NBA, the offseason, and already there's all sorts of juicy stuff. Are the Warriors in danger of becoming a team suffering from the disease of me? LeBron James, where is he going? And Lonzo Ball, where might he end up? NBA offseason, the drama begins. That's next. Luke Lipinski, Dan Bickley, Arizona Sports, 98.7 FM, your Arizona sports station.
98.7 FM, Arizona's sports station. Suns Insider Update.
All right, the NBA draft upcoming. We're sending listeners along with me to New York City to enjoy the festivities, which will actually take place in Brooklyn at the Barclays Center.
Not actually with you, though, right? You guys aren't driving like a minivan across country?
No, they're all hanging out in my hotel.
Oh, okay. All right, I didn't know that.
That's the kind of deal. That's what makes the prize so great, man.
Not written in the copy in front of me.
They get to hang with the freak show that is me, Luke. All right, DeAndre Ayton, you just said something really, really funny, and that is, isn't it awesome that the Suns have the number one draft in a year when the guy coming out of college is going to be the best player in the history of basketball?
I'm a little nervous because we set the bar so high. Uh-huh. I'm assuming Jarrett's running the show Twitter account. What did he tweet out today? Maybe, and now I can't find it, but somebody tweeted out that, do you have any concerns with DeAndre Ayton? Which, I think is a fair question. We're talking about a 19-year-old that is going to be the number one pick in the draft.
Here, I'll read the responses. Ready?
Yeah.
The question is, Suns fans, do you have any concerns about the Suns taking DeAndre Ayton number one? This is in order I'm reading the responses. No. No. Hell no. 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 There's always some concerns. That said, I have none. No. No. I'm concerned they won't take him at number one. And then some other ones.
What's going to happen if he's not? Like, what does he have to be now to satisfy everybody?
He's got to be Wilt Chamberlain, David Robinson, and Hakeem Olajuwon all rolled into one.
Because I'm more than content if he comes in here and makes the Suns better and hovers around being an all-star. But I feel like the bar is higher than number one pick now. I feel like we're talking like if you drafted all the players from the last 10 years, he'd be like a top two or three pick. That's the way we're talking about him now.
Well, and you want to know what the danger about this is that say you're Ryan McDonough, and say Igor Kokoshkov comes to you and says, Ryan, I know that this is not my decision, and I know that I'm not going to get involved in this because I might be biased, but I'm telling you, this Luka Doncic kid is unbelievable. Maybe Ryan McDonough is watching tapes and goes, man, this Jaren Jackson Jr. guy, whew, I really dig this guy.
Yeah.
Think of the public pressure and think of the reaction if the Suns think outside the box and don't agree with the groupthink that DeAndre Ayton is all that and take somebody else.
Can't.
You can't.
You can't do it.
So when does this I would say borderline delusional belief that there is no chance of busting with DeAndre Ayton become an impediment to the franchise?
Just, there's a distinction that needs to be drawn between thinking he should be the number one pick, which, I don't know anybody at the station who doesn't think he should be the number one pick other than Kellen. And there's people that have concerns, but I think if you look at everything, you still ultimately, like you said yesterday, you get there eventually, you come to the conclusion Ayton should be the number one pick. There's a difference between Ayton should be the number one pick and Ayton is the greatest basketball player ever.
Of all time. That you're exactly right. And he's not. And I don't know, man.
How about this? I'm willing to risk it that I will openly say how stupid I feel 15 years from now if he's better than Jordan.
Yes,
because that's the way we're talking about him.
I know. Yes, and that's not going to happen. But I do like DeAndre Ayton. The story I sampled and read those clips from earlier in the program.
He seems very likable.
I like the personality. Yeah. I really do. And you know what? You brought up something earlier. I do believe. And Vinny argues with me about this all the time. I do believe there's great value in not only having a good team, but having some personalities. I look at the Diamondbacks, and you look at the rise of Archie Bradley. Why is he so popular? Well, he stands out among a team that is just so buttoned up. There's nothing. You don't have these wild, crazy personalities on this team where your two best players, Paul Goldschmidt, Zach Greinke, both of them, I mean, you get nothing personality-wise from either for different reasons.
And it's very noticeable when you're struggling, right? When you're winning, ultimately, who cares when you're winning? You care a little bit for the entertainment value, but when you're losing, you have nothing if you don't have some personality.
And I would counter by saying that even if you're winning, you bring in casual fans to the festivities, and those casual fans, they want more than just X's and O's, runs and baskets. They want to feel part of this a big community loving, if you will. So having some sort of personality on your team, to me, it's a very, very good thing, particularly in this market. People here will get behind good teams. People here will go nuts over good teams with great personalities.
Especially if it's the Suns.
Look at the 92-93 Suns. I mean, part of the reason why that team just made everybody swoon was the humor of Charles Barkley, the status of Dan Marley, all of it. Kevin Johnson dunking on Hakeem Olajuwon, just all of that stuff.
You have to have that.
I think you do.
Because at the basis of it, sports is entertainment, is it not?
Yeah.
And so that's why you need to have that factor to it, because there's only going to be one team that ultimately wins the championship at the end of the season. Even that 92-93 Suns team you're talking about didn't ultimately win, but you had that personality which just enhances the whole ride.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. And so to me, DeAndre Ayton checks that box. Jared Dudley, why is he so popular? Great personality. So I like that a lot. But I just would caution people here in the Valley, open your minds a little bit and understand no sure things in the NBA draft.
I'm getting tweets back now saying I'm overreacting.
You're overreacting.
I've heard him compared to Wilt Chamberlain, a more elite version skill set-wise of Shaq, Hakeem, and David Robinson with a jumper. If he's those four players rolled into one, he
Garnett
is better than
Embiid.
Michael Jordan. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility he is Garnett and Embiid or something like that. But when you're telling me he's going to be Wilt Chamberlain, Shaq, Hakeem, and David Robinson rolled into one, you are talking about a player that we have never seen.
Yeah. No, that is – yeah. And again, so tap the brakes on that. If anybody's overreacting, it's not us. It's you people.
I just don't want Ayton to hear it. I just want him to come in here and be himself and be an all-star guy. And be the guy that this team needs.
I'm going
to
tweet out, Luke Lipinski thinks DeAndre Ayton is overrated.
Please do. Please try.
What do you think about that?
I don't think he's overrated,
there
so go ahead and do that too.
All right, other basketball news. The Warriors had a very interesting victory parade / celebration. Generally, these things are just great. We saw Travis Kelce with the Eagles and how awesome he was. That scene in Philly was great. The scene with the Warriors was a little bit weird. You had Draymond Green trolling LeBron James again with a T-shirt. Okay, good enough. But then you had these guys taking zingers at Kevin Durant about his contract status, and you could see him roll his eyes, and he didn't look like he was down with that at all.
I have a couple of cuts here. The first one, kind of a funny joke. The second one did not land very well. So here's the first one.
Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, you guys can sit there. You're much taller than me. I'm going to stand in front of KD before his Warrior exit. I want to enjoy as much time with him as possible. Steph, we'll smooth Bob over later on. Any contract you want, Kev, I promise. Steph.
All right, so any contract you want, but then later on.
I heard you tell Kevin Durant he can have whatever contract he wants next year.
Yeah, that was just for the media. He can't have anything like that at all.
Mid-level.
Yeah, mid-level. Behind closed doors.
Because I think last year he told Steph he could have any contract he wants to.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, that was different. He's been here from the run, the way before days. He's earned it.
All right.
Yeah, that was awkward.
Steph has been here from the way before days. He's earned it. I said yesterday when Bob Myers came out and said Kevin Durant can have anything he wanted, I thought that's a good way to approach this impending offseason. He completely flipped that yesterday.
Yeah.
Now he made a joke. Oh, I was just kidding. That was for the media. That only really applies to Steph.
That's where you start to walk down a fine line if you're just trying to make a joke when you start to compare an all-star to one of his teammates. That's
yeah.
Where there's an issue, right?
It can be slightly problematic.
I don't know that you want to do that. Now, no. Kevin Durant can handle it. Steph Curry can handle it.
I don't know if,
I don't know if Kevin Durant can handle it.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't either. Kevin Durant, there's gunpowder between his ears. How many times did he lose his mind during the NBA season? He's mentally very strange.
Well, okay, he can handle it as long as he's winning the title every year.
Yeah. So the question becomes, Draymond Green, he's not eligible for an extension for a couple of years. But if he unlocks this code of Defensive Player of the Year, All-NBA, he'll be available for a Supermax, and he said that's what he wants. Klay Thompson, his contract extension's no guarantee. I guess what I'm getting at is when you throw in David West's comments about how this team wasn't always the height of a brotherhood and had a lot of dysfunction behind the scenes, maybe it's not a sure thing that this dynasty just keeps going and going and going.
Well, I hear what you're saying, mm-hmm. and I think that there needs to be a little more respect given to Steve Kerr and what he has done for that team, because that's probably not easy to manage egos like that. I mean, that was when people piled on Phil Jackson or tried to find flaw with him, and they said, well, you're winning titles because you've got Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Kobe Bryant and Shaq. The response from Phil Jackson's camp was, it's not as easy as you think to manage all these egos.
Yeah.
And I do think there's probably a pretty strong element of that with Steve Kerr right now. I'm still picking the Warriors to win next year and probably the win after. But there's something to the idea that once things start to go wrong for this team, because they will eventually, there do seem to be maybe a few rifts that might become real evident real quick.
I know. Speaking of rifts now, we told you yesterday about Lonzo Ball coming out with another rap track where he dissed Kyle Kuzma in a song named Kylie Kuzma. Gives him a girl's title, disses him in the rap track. The Lakers are not at all happy with Lonzo for this, because that's teammate-on-teammate crime in some way.
Yeah.
The more and more I think about this, and especially if LeBron ends up in Los Angeles, they are going to trade Lonzo Ball. Because I'm almost going to guarantee you that LeBron James will have told Magic Johnson, I will sign with you guys, you get that father out of here. Yeah, I almost guarantee you.
I can't picture LeBron James playing for LeVar Ball's son's team. You know
no,
what I mean?
Right. That will be a precursor. That will be a deal breaker. And Lonzo Ball will be traded at LeBron James's behest.
That seems so crazy on the surface, because I remember sitting actually in this stadium last year when the Lakers got the second pick in the draft lottery and how happy the Lakers were to get Lonzo Ball. But you can't underestimate the clout that LeBron has.
No.
So if he were to make that a stipulation, and I don't know if he will, but if he does, if he's like, yeah, I'll come there, but I'm not – trade Lonzo and get me this piece.
Yeah.
That's what it would be. You could trade Lonzo and get some really nice pieces.
That's exactly right. All right, coming up on the other side, we're going to get you prepped up for today's Diamondbacks game. Look at the scoreboard, Luke. Diamondbacks back in first place by three. You can't see it now. Back, looking at
a picture of Mookie Betts.
Right. They have got a three-game lead, but the Dodgers and the Diamondbacks are both 8-2 over the last 10 games. Is that a precursor of what is really to come in the National League West? That's next. He's Luke Lipinski. I'm Dan Bickley. You're listening to 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.
The home of Arizona Diamondbacks baseball is 98.7 FM, Arizona's sports station. We're checking in on the Diamondbacks as they warm up for the game's first pitch. D-backs on deck. Presented by Cox. Get Cox high-speed internet for $29.99 a month for 12 months and ask about panoramic Wi-Fi. Learn more at cox.com.
All right, time for the D-backs on deck show. Pretty good place to do it from since we're out on the deck here in right field.
Well, you're right. That's a great point.
See how that worked out. Diamondbacks looking for the sweep this afternoon against the Pittsburgh Pirates, and we will start you off with the pitching matchup, which is brought to you by Berg Simpson Law Firm. When the game's on the line and you've been injured, nobody matches up to Berg Simpson. Visit BergSimpson.com. That's BurgSimpson.com. It's a good one, at least for the Diamondbacks. Zach Greinke on the mound. He will be opposed by Jameson Taillon. Greinke 5-4 in the year. Taillon 3-5. Should point out, though, Taillon won his first two starts of the year and has won just one time since April 8th.
Wow.
So
okay,
might be a good time to catch him. I mean, he hasn't pitched badly in all those games, but he only has one more actual decision that's a win since April 8th.
All right, so a couple things about this game that are appealing to me. Number one, the obvious. The Diamondbacks can post ace a sweep against the Pirates, and I really like the sound of that and how it kind of like translates to the arc of the season. What I really like, though, is aside from the hitting, which is obvious, when you look at game one of this series, you saw a team that scored, what, 9 runs in the last 2 innings. Yesterday, they scored 6 more in the first. That's 15 in the span of 3 innings.
Yep.
That was something we would have never imagined from this team a month ago, when they struggled to score runs mightily. But the thing that makes this interesting to me is that the way they won that first game, being down 5-0 in a game in which Torey Lovello has admitted on a number of different times that he was ready to just sort of like wave the white flag and make decisions based on winning tomorrow's game, not today's game. That's when Clint Hurdle did or did not order a hit by pitch to start an inning, and then boom, it just opened the floodgates. It's a real embarrassing moment for the Pirates, and it really looks poor on their strategy and their misguided manliness, if you will, that they felt that being the way they are with retaliation pitches meant that hit the next guy up right now. I don't care if it's Chris Owings. I don't care if there's nobody else. Hit him right now.
It's Clay Buchholz, when he was sitting up here with us last hour, and you sort of pressed him on it, he was like, yeah, why do it with no outs? I mean, that's the most basic thing. Why would you do it with no outs?
Because you are more concerned with your reputation as a hardcore old-school team than winning a game first and proving the point later. But what it did to me,
it hurt the Rockies and the Dodgers and the Giants more than the Pirates. If that's it.
Isn't that
the Diamondbacks
true?
Win the division by one game?
Could you imagine that? So now, I think, but in the dugout of the Diamondbacks, being able to do that, you can't convince me that a guy getting hit by a pitch to start an inning suddenly fired up a team that had been really struggling against Musgrove, okay? I don't think it works like that. I don't think you just suddenly get more angry and now you're better.
It doesn't work in baseball.
It doesn't work in baseball.
You don't swing harder and hit the ball further.
Exactly. So to me, that was a convenient thing to say, yeah, reset our dugout. Yeah, got our guys locked back in. It's easy to say that. But in retrospect, when you take a moment like that and then blow the doors off the team that had been pretty much dominating you that game, that's a powerful thing to think that you can do, even if it's not true. That, hey, look at how we handled that situation. It's got to help the overall confidence of this team going forward. And it's only a moment in a game in time. But to turn a game on something like that and then to win it going away, that's what I take away from this series more than anything.
I thought it was more symbolic, too, than maybe anything else. When this team wasn't struggling in late March and April, you still never felt like they were out of a game. They weren't scoring, but they were still finding ways. You know, if they were down 3-2, they would come back and win 4-3. It never felt like they were out of a contest. And yet in May, once we got a couple weeks into May, it felt like, well, the other team has two runs. They're done. They can't score two runs, and they certainly can't score three runs. Now you've got a team, they've won five in a row. They've scored 51 runs in those five games.
Yeah.
And over this 14-game stretch where they're 11-3, they've scored 103 runs, which is averaging about 7.5 a game. That's not just a team that all of a sudden can score more than two runs. You score like that all season, you're the highest scoring team in baseball. It's not even close.
Yeah, and again, it's the flip-flopping nature of the season is just mind-blowing to people because there were a lot of people who declared the Diamondbacks DOA. If not the team, then certainly their offense. I know Vinny was getting very, very pessimistic about where this season was going.
He just said Vince was getting pessimistic.
Yeah. Imagine that, right? So in this situation, I don't know what explains it. I hope, and what I think is this, I think whatever this tunneling approach happened to be, I think at some point in time, hitters were encouraged or decided, okay, I'm going to take some of this with a grain of salt, and I'm going to go back up there and just incorporate some of the stuff I was doing before. I'm going to get back to just seeing the ball and hitting the ball. I'll be cognizant of this stuff, whatever. And I think that's the best way to kind of explain what happened. So John Jay, who joined us earlier today, back in the leadoff slot today, finally had a good day with the Diamondbacks. That's a good sign. I don't know about you, but every time I look at the lineup, I just feel so much better now that Jake Lamb is back in the batting order.
Yeah, that's almost been overlooked. You wondered when they weren't able to score any runs, is just getting Paul Goldschmidt back to being Paul Goldschmidt going to be enough? Now, if he's going to hit like this, then it probably would be enough. But it hasn't just been that. It's been Ketel Marte hitting. It's been Jake Lamb back in the lineup. It's been other guys now hitting the ball as well. That you wouldn't think that would go as something that could fly under the radar from what Jake Lamb has meant to this team in years past.
Yeah.
But it has almost gotten lost in the shuffle of what he has done for this offense, just having him there.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Day game today, Zach Greinke on the mound, chance for a sweep, chance to keep this going in the National League West. Like I said, you look up in the standings now, the Dodgers and the D-backs are both 8-2 over the last 10 games. They're the only two teams that are above 500 in the division, and then on top of that, it kind of like paints this picture that a team that we thought was dead on arrival a while ago, the Dodgers, they're kind of getting it rolling a little bit. The Diamondbacks are back on track. This could be not only a great summer of baseball in Arizona, but it could be a nightly give and take with the Dodgers. And that would help put this thing over the top. Because if there's one thing that Arizona sports fans like more than a good team that's in playoff contention, bring in a reason to hate LA teams.
Yeah.
And that puts it over the top.
Yeah, if you edge out the Rockies for first place with like 3 days left in the season or something, that's great because you're making the playoffs. But if you edge out the Dodgers, doesn't that make it, especially this year with the expectations heaped on the Dodgers heading into the year, and rightfully so, a lot of people had them as the World Series favorites or at least a team that was going to be close and maybe get back to the World Series, and they're coming off the year they had last season. You want to edge them out at the last possible second if you can. And to your point, it felt like they were so close to burying LA at the start of May. It is just, the more you look at the numbers, and so it was May 8th they beat the Dodgers 8-5 and 12. And at that point, I want to say the Dodgers were 8 or 9 behind the Diamondbacks. They were in that range. Then the Diamondbacks went on that 17-game stretch where they won two games and scored 34 runs in 17 games. And since then, in 14 games, they've scored 103. You want to talk about just flipping the switch, just turning on a dime twice.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. And yesterday, the Pirates were throwing the ball all over the yard. They looked like just a little league team in the way they played. And I also like seeing that, even though they rallied and Clay Buchholz wasn't that good, I love to see teams with inferior defense do that stuff because it kind of brings to light how well the Diamondbacks can be defensively when they happen to be going right. Ketel Marte, his hot streak, the way he's turned things around, that's made a big difference in this offense. And, you know, the team is still going to get A.J. Pollock back. They're going to get Robbie Ray back. Shelby Miller, who knows? His last rehab start wasn't so good. He's going to get another one this coming weekend. To me, there's no guarantee he makes it back this year. I think his performances are going to have to dictate it.
Yeah, that's probably fair because they may have a surplus at starting pitching if everybody's healthy. But that's the injury report. You're doing this without Robbie Ray and Steven Souza and Shelby Miller, who you've been doing it without for a year and a half now, and A.J. Pollock. Let's get into the keys to the game.
Listen, man, I need you to be the key master.
I am the key master.
D-backs Keys to the Game, brought to you by your Valley Chevy dealers, the most awarded and fastest growing brand 4 years in a row. Find your Chevy today. Visit valleychevy.com.
All right, Luke, my key to the game is going to be early intensity. Those who watched last night's game know it took about 7 days to complete, okay? So the players got done with that. They come back. You've got an early afternoon start. You know, sometimes baseball players launched out of their routine. You can take the field in a sleepy manner, let the game kind of unfold. They need, and this used to be one of their problems last year, take the field with optimum intensity and roll it from there.
And I would just piggyback on top of that and say it would be nice with Zach Greinke on the mound to see them hold the Pirates down. As much as the Diamondbacks have been scoring, they've allowed 23 runs in the last four games. Nice to see a good, solid pitching start today.
There you go. That is your Diamondbacks On Deck report. He's Luke Lipinski. I'm Dan Bickley. Next, the Bickley Blast. You're listening to 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station.